It's time now for the Weekly Word with Professor Hines and Jason Spies. And we're being joined this week by Sterling Bennett, PhD, Senior Fellow, and Managing Editor with the Heartland Institute.
When it's time to put the booze down.
Over the past few months, I've told you about how unbelievable Hatch coaching is. Don't just take my word for it. Listen to what Christy Huber, President of the United Way of Cass Clay, says about Hatch coaching.
I think it's a really exciting time for our young leaders today because leaders like Eric Hatch are changing the face of what it means to lead an organization or what it means to lead a brand. He's changing that. For many years, I think that the gold standard of leadership has been somebody who is very polished and has it all together or seemingly has it all together. And throughout the years, I think that we've now, especially with technology and social media, we are drawn to what's real.
To find out more about Hatch Coaching or to have Eric Hatch speak at your event or company, visit hatchcoaching.com. That's hatchcoaching.com or call 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. All right, time now for the Weekly Word. We're being joined by Sterling Bennett, a Heartland Senior Fellow on Environmental Policy and the Managing Editor of Environment and Climate News. Of course, we also have Professor Stephen Hines with us. How's everybody doing today?
All right. Hi, Jason. Hi, Sterling.
Hello.
And this is the word. This is the word man, Steve Hines.
This is Sterling Bennett, the Heartland Institute. I'm pleased you had me on. I appreciate it. Yes, I was doing well. A little bit of a cold over this cold winter. Sure proof of global warming as I look outside. And you talk about Environment and Climate News. Well, Environment and Climate News is a monthly newspaper, 10 months a year. We send to every state legislator in the country and all the executives, all the agencies, in addition to the federal government. We cover environment and climate news from a market-oriented perspective, but it's news. We leave our whatever our particular biases out of the news. But you get views from people who we quote in our stories. And we also cover, I have a weekly newsletter that's called Climate Change Weekly that covers science, economics, and policy stories and climate change. I go through a couple of dozen or more stories a week trying to decide which are the best four or five, and those are the ones I cover.
Sure. And you do a good job, by the way.
I appreciate you saying so.
Outstanding. Great. No problem. I was going to comment. I'm just on the beginning parts of a cold here. I'm going to kick in some that fizzy vitamin C stuff a little bit later on. But I wrote down the climate change from a market perspective because I think that's fantastic that someone is doing that. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to bring you on the program today is to really show how it is. You know, I mean, when we live in this global economy and jobs, and I'm sorry, as soon as you get a car loan or you get a bank loan or you get a student loan, you need a job. And so you're part of that economy. And so, you know, when I start seeing things from a climate perspective, I think that's fantastic. And I'd like to just kind of start off a little bit by an easy one, I would imagine, which is the coal industry. How did you guys talk about the coal industry from a climate perspective? Because, you know, that one seems like, I guess it would be a pretty easy one to kind of talk about how you guys took a look at it.
Well, we've always looked at, our view on energy is, I don't know if you call it all of the above. I think you call it all that makes sense.
There you are.
Energy is the lifeblood of every economy. And economies that have more abundant, regular, not sporadic energy, on-demand energy, economies that have relatively cheap energy, those economies thrive and grow, their people prosper, and their environment is actually better.
The private sector could do a better job of highlighting that about themselves.
Well, I think to be fair to the private sector, and to be fair to and to be fair to understanding their role, they're not the private sector is not. They're out there to do business, you know. You look at someone like Ayn Rand, who wrote about this. Their job is making money for their investors, and the problem for the private sector is when they do try and promote themselves and tell that story, and they do. I've seen the commercials, I've seen the ads and in newspapers. The problem is people say, oh, well, they're businessmen, so you can't trust them. And that's where people like Harland, groups like Harland and others, have a role to play, because we can tell the story, and we're not, we can't be accused, fairly at least,
right,
of profiting from telling that story. We tell that story because it's the truth. And
well,
for Cole,
I've been calling for full disclosure from everybody. You know, one of the things you do is you identify, you know, who you are and what you do early. There are this report that UCLA, Chicago, and Harvard did. You don't know who paid for it. I mean, they have so many things they should disclose to us so we can understand more about the study itself.
Well, I don't know. I've got mixed feelings on that, I guess because of my background in philosophy. My training is ethics. And
right,
what I'm taught is that it doesn't matter who makes the arguments. Their motives don't matter. The argument stands or falls on its own. They're either telling the truth or they're not. And you can discover that not based on who they are or who funds them, but based on do the premises lead to the conclusion, and are the premises true? And if that's the case, as far as I can tell, even the devil can make a sound argument.
Well, you know, the problem is I read a lot, right? I have 40 or 45 Google searches, alerts every day. So I read about, you know, emission in India, for example. And I read, if it's an important story, I read it from five or six different points of view. The environmental community has figured out if they can discount you, if not ignore you, by just saying you're from the private sector, or you've received money. You know, in some cases, if you receive two bottle caps, they'll call you. You know, sold out to an industry. But they are really, in a perfect world, you're right. In a world where the Marquess of Queensbury rules apply, but the extremists are not playing that way.
Well, but the thing about them though is. Many of the studies that I look at, and I look at, like I said, dozens of studies a week, are funded by governments, and you can point that out. It's pretty clear. You know, if the DOE does a study, well, that's the government. But it's hard for people from my side to get a lot of traction by saying, oh, well, you can't trust the government. You know, you can't trust DOE. Because we saw those studies as well. But by the same token, when someone like Harland or our allies, people who, as I view it, try and promote climate reality and energy reality, is the important point. When we point out that, when people complain, oh, well, you get your funding from X, Y, or Z, we get such a minuscule amount of funding. They come to us for our views. They don't fund us to produce views. And we look at it and we say, well, okay, let's say we get X amount of money from Y or Z. How many billions of dollars has the climate alarm industry gotten? Governments, but not all of it, but most of it from governments. And all that money goes away. All that money goes away if they are proven wrong. And you tell me that has a bigger incentive to keep telling, to keep to their party line.
Well, you know, and my problem is I read, you know, national science, all the people who you used to trust, it really has become a them or us. And even I can't find a science magazine that hasn't been compromised by the environmental thinking, if not by groups.
Well, it's unfortunately it's not a new story. It's It's not a new story. It goes back. If you look at, a lot of people look at, have heard or heard of Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address as president, because he that's where he coined the term the military-industrial complex and warned of the growing military-industrial complex. But nobody reads the second half of that speech. The second half of that speech warns of the growing government science complex, where government is co-opting the sciences by putting big dollars into universities. And so universities are producing results that call for more government.
No question. You know, I've got examples of bad behavior on Harvard Medical School and the school itself. You know, I'm honestly, in some ways, it's kind of embarrassing. You know, the Ivy League schools have bought much of the same proposition, of course, because of endowments. It really has become over politicized. Is really my point. And you have to be aware that it has been made that way, because the way out is the way you're doing it, the way we're doing it, and that is the people who really know the most about these are the people who deal with these issues, boots on the ground kind of ideas, instead of, you know, ivory tower thinking someplace in, you know, on K Street or in San Francisco or Boulder.
Yeah.
You know,
let me get back to Jason's question real quick. So he asked about coal, and so when we're talking about energy at the Heartland Institute, I say we like all of it makes sense. What we really like is all energy sources to be treated equally. Put them on an equal playing, a level playing field, and let them compete in the marketplace, because that's what we're about. Markets bring efficiency, they produce plenty, and they produce plenty relatively cheaply compared to other kinds of economies. So we want plentiful energy, reliable energy, and relatively inexpensive energy. And so we say, let energy sources compete. And it turns out coal competes quite well. In fact, existing coal plants, with older coal plants, they're the cheapest source of energy. The states that have the highest percentage of coal have the cheapest source of electricity. Natural gas is the cheapest new source of electricity. But you know what's the last in line? Well, second to last is wind. Third to last is solar. Second to last is wind. Last is solar. And solar is the most expensive source of energy. And yet we're subsidizing that. We're spending more government dollars to encourage people to adopt one of the least reliable, highest cost sources of energy and incorporate it into the grid, making it less reliable. That doesn't make sense.
Well, and then there's the technology risk. I was at a conference, at a Nehru conference, and they were talking about electric vehicles and blah, 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 blah. You know, and I said, you know, you talk about, and they were talking about, you know, solar for power. And I said, well, you're talking, what about the technology risk? What happens if you make an investment in this idea, the solar idea, and 3 or 4 years from now, it's out of vogue, it no longer is as best state of the art?
Let me be clear.
I have friends in Wisconsin who did a solar roof 10 years ago, and they're environmentalists, and they stopped using it 5 years ago.
Yeah, well, no one talks about the weaknesses of it. But also, the problem there is, if your friends and neighbors want to put solar panels on their roofs, we've got no problem with that. We say more power to them. But the taxpayer shouldn't have to subsidize that decision.
Exactly.
More importantly, when the government gets involved in something, it sucks a lot of the private sector funding out of the room as well. They say, well, if this is what the government's got back, this is where we're going to put our money. And so great ideas that may be better than current technologies, whether they be solar, wind, whatever, or maybe an improvement on those, they don't get the funding because the funding is going towards those sources where the government's throwing its money out. It dries up money in the private sector. So we think that the government should stay out of it altogether. We encourage people to make investments where they want to make whatever investment they want to make, but government shouldn't be in the job of taking taxpayer money and, in their wisdom in Washington, D.C., deciding where the best investment is, because they don't make good decisions with regards to our money.
Well, you know, and one of the things, I've been fighting the Clean Power Plan as you probably know, Sterling. And I think, you know, I came up with 25 flaws, and I don't think anybody's gone that far. So either I'm obsessive or it was good, including the fact it was unconstitutional. But I think that, these arguments should be had, and arguments is the wrong word. These discussions, which I think we try and do, Jason and I both try and do, but there an awful lot of premises are based on false information, and for guys like me, when I can't find out that the EPA's who the former administration wanted transparency, but they won't give it in return. I can't find out from Gina McCarthy that Harvard study, six-city study back from 1993 or 94, because they say it isn't our property, but they use it. They used it for the Clean Power Plan.
Well, let's get into something that would solve some of those issues, because there have been bills that, of course, didn't pass under the previous administration, but they have a chance here if the Senate will do its job. The House has already passed these bills. You have to get the swamp creatures in the Senate to say we're not going to let a minority hold out good legislation and pass something called it used to be the Secret Science Act, and it's not the Secret Science Act anymore. It's I forget the acronym for it, but basically it says any science used by the EPA to make regulations has to be transparent. And by that they mean it has to be all the data, all the sources, all the information surrounding it has to be available to the public, has to be available to researchers for retesting, for confirmation. And if the taxpayers pay for it, by God, the taxpayers have access to it. And any agency that uses that research has to make that available. If they don't, they can't use it, and they can't make regulations based upon it. We've got privacy concerns. We've got this or that. It's not ours. Okay, then you can't use it. You can use anyone you can use, and you can't fund it. If we don't have access to it, if we're giving money for it, we have access. And if the researchers involved don't want to play by that rule, they just don't get the money.
Well, remember the famous hockey stick. I mean, speaking of a guy who was hid behind proprietary information to create the hockey stick in silence, in secret, we don't know how he used the facts. In many cases, we think he is abusive, but we can't find out why, because he keeps them to himself. How can you do a study that is supposed to be globally important and not allow access to how you came to your conclusions?
I remember the name of the bill. It's called the Regulations of the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act, the RAINS Act. So it's reining in regulations by ensuring that they are transparent.
Well, you know, the problem is the secrecy sort of overwhelmed the EPA. You know, by the end, by 2011, 2012, if everything that was a PR on anything in any division had to go through Gina McCarthy, had to go through her office.
That's the point. If this bill passes, you shouldn't need the bill, but you do. That's just the state of the world. But if this bill passes, if it becomes law, then McCarthy can't do this anymore. No one can do it. It doesn't matter who they are. If an agency, in this case it's the EPA, but I think it should stand for all agencies, the same rule for all agencies.
Yes, you're right.
That if they're going to cite a study, that study's research, the data, the assumptions, everything has to be available for testing by the researchers and available to the public for review. And that would solve it. You hope it would solve it. Government bureaucrats can always try and figure out ways to get around something, which is, of course, what McCarthy did. When the Congress has oversight over these agencies. And under Lamar Smith, who was the chairman of the Science Committee in the House, they had to issue the first subpoenas in history to get information from agencies they have legal oversight over. These agencies, if Congress comes to these agencies and says, give us this, those agencies are supposed to comply because their funding, their very existence depends upon Congress, and McCarthy ignored. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, ignored, and they had to issue subpoenas to force them to turn over data, and even then they haven't turned over all the data.
Well, the news story is this, Sterling, that the EPA is trying to catch up on everything because everything has fallen behind, leasing, government property, I mean, the list is long. And the executive decisions are long. So there is this fight over things that have never been law. They were just one person or a group who made it, and is so anti-democratic because we did not have a chance to make and participate in any of that legislation. And that just totally wrong. And 2.5 years later, the current EPA is trying to catch up with the subpoenas that have been ignored for 2.5 years.
Well, I think that's optimistic on your part. You think they're actually trying to catch up. I'm not convinced they're doing anything to try and catch up at all. I think they're just ignoring them. But
I think that we have the right guy running the department now. So I think he's going to try and write it all, including making sure that of the promises in and around use of federal land, which is what 1/3 of all of our land in America is federal land. So it's not as if we're doing without it.
No, I agree with you. We have the right people, and you have the right people at the heads, but you don't always have the right people lower down, and lower level functionaries. They can slow the process if they want to, and believe me, they are.
You know, and they're walking around. You know, they might as well have a white foot because they're, you know, 100 are now sort of leaking news, talking about, you know, how much Pruitt spends for, travel. Come on, nobody asks Jeannie of that. They complain about, they need security. A little poor Scott Pruitt needs about 8 or 9 times as much. Because, speaking of wing nuts, but nobody wants to claim credit for those people who are claiming that Scott Pruitt's, you know, changing the law. And the truth is, the law wasn't a law in the first place.
That's right. That's right. It was legislation through regulation. I'm sorry, I read my Constitution. The president isn't authorized to legislate. That's what Congress is for.
And I had the suspicion.
He's to carry out their wishes. He is to carry out the wishes of Congress. He's the executive.
Well, and we were talking to somebody, said, well, it's an executive order. And he said, in case you haven't noticed, we have a new executive.
Yeah.
Which means he doesn't have to live with any of the previous executive orders. If they don't.
That's one of the things. That's one of the things that Obama got right. Elections matter. Elections matter. That's one of the things he said. He says, look, folks, I got elected. Elections matter. I'm going to work. Well, guess what? The same thing goes for President Trump.
Well, one other thing. I almost got hit in the mouth. California guy right after the election. You know, and I quoted Obama in 2000. I don't do politics, but this is jurisprudence, so I don't mind doing it. But 2013, Obama was quoted as saying, "I don't need a majority in Congress. I've got a pen and a phone."
That's how he acted. And to be fair, all presidents do that to some extent, and I think it's wrong for all of them to do that. I've read the Constitution. They're supposed to carry out.
Lincoln got rid of habeas corpus for a couple, 3 years. Nobody can point to any injustice he did. It just gave him another weapon in his bag.
Well, some of the Southerners might disagree with that.
And some
of the people he locked up, by the way, and it's including senators from Ohio who had to flee the country, might also disagree with that.
I know, Sterling. And we can squabble about, but the truth is, what people like Obama did, people like Pruitt, and like the Secretary of Interior, they're just not enforcing his administrative rules. It's not rolling back anything.
Yeah. Well, some of it is. Some of it's rolling back. Some of it's not carrying out his orders. And they'll be sued for that. Let's face it. Lawsuits are flying already.
All pipelines, in fact. They're everywhere.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of progress made in the Trump administration on a lot of energy issues. The Clean Power Plan is halted. My concern is he's going to write his own rather than just stop this one.
He needs to write his own because what they're arguing is something has to replace the Clean Power Plan. It's just, you know, it should be replaced, and of course it should never have been written in the first place.
My point is he doesn't have to do something. There's no law that says you have to repeal and replace Obamacare, and there's no law that says you have to repeal and replace the Clean Power Plan. You could just repeal it. And if you're worried he has to do something, that's forced on Trump by something called the endangerment finding where the EPA determined using UN, not doing any original science on its own, just citing the UN, saying that carbon dioxide is a hazard to human health and the environment, is a pollutant, a danger to human health and the environment, and so we must regulate it. And the point there is, as long as that exists, they do have to do something. And that's why Trump and the Trump administration, Scott Pruitt at EPA, needs to rescind the endangerment finding so they don't have to carry out their own Clean Power Plan, because there's no good Clean Power Plan.
That's political dynamite. That's all I'm saying. I couldn't agree with you more. The politics of it all, I was there and watched ExxonMobil. You know, the largest energy provider in the world is sort of, they're acting as if they have nothing to be proud of.
ExxonMobil is trying to benefit at the expense of coal. They've got all this natural gas. They say, hey, go ahead, shut coal down. That's more money in their pocket, and they're doing it, saying, "Oh, we're clean, and we're worried about climate change. So go ahead and shut down coal." But what the bottom line is they're going to benefit if they shut down coal, and that's what it's really all about. ExxonMobil and a lot of companies have drank the Kool-Aid as if the environmentalists aren't going to shut them down after they shut down the coal industry.
Well, exactly. Exactly. And it's, it's throwing, hopefully we won't have to throw peanuts to the elephants anymore. But, until we stop that, we're stuck with the politicization of energy and the environment. That's just all there is to it right now. And that's the reality, and Jason and I face it every day. And I'm sure you do too. Too many cliches apply to all of this. Well, he got $222 from the Rockefeller Foundation. Actually, nobody ever says he got money from the Rockefeller. I wish they would start having to say they got their grant was from the EPA, and it was for a study, and here's how much money they got. We don't know. We don't know without the Freedom of Information right now. A lot of money has swished around over the last 8 years.
Not just 8 years. More money has been spent on climate issues in the last decade and a half than was spent cumulatively in the entire discipline up to that point in time. And the more alarming the pronouncements, the more money government throws at it. You think that people doing the research don't know that? That if tomorrow they come out with research that shows, guess what? We were wrong. Humans humans do affect the climate, there's no question about that. But they're not causing disaster, they're not causing catastrophe. We don't have to remake the whole economic system. That money would dry up overnight, that it'd go to other things. So that gravy train, they're on the gravy train, and they're not letting the spigot be shut off.
Honestly, we're not going to let
evidence means nothing. Data means nothing. They'll manipulate it to get the results. with support, more funding for them.
By 43% that don't, but you know, that's part of the correction process. You know, they realize that climate change isn't the doorway to funding. But you know, somehow in my mind, Sterling, here's what I envision: like somebody who works on Wall Street. You tell us what your return on investment is for 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, and environmentalists should tell us. They predicted this then, and here's where we are now. I mean, so that they can't get away with throwing stuff up and not having to answer what they predicted 10 years ago.
Well, that's true. I agree with you 100%. And that's one of the things that Heartland really hammers on. The stuff that we work on, we don't look at climate models. We look at data. We say, what does the actual data show? What did you say would happen? What did you say should be happening based upon your assumptions and your climate models, and does it match reality? And if it doesn't, it's not our lying eyes and the data that's wrong. It's the models and your projections that are wrong. And that's what we hammer every week.
What's so important about Sue Mickley's interview, which it should be, you know, over the next day or so, but it's dependent on me writing up, you know, along with the interview. But she's just used Pennsylvania data on fracking intensive counties and showing the real health benefit both for children and for seniors. And unsurprisingly, in fact, it's a net benefit to the county. Why? Because of its economic features. One county built a new hospital, but it provides health care. I mean, the kind of things that money provides, it's not surprising that it provides for these counties. And forget about what people tell you, that it ain't poetic to be, you know, in a poor county. Just ask a number of them in New York State.
Yeah.
Why? Because you get nothing. You have a shrinking population base, or your tax. You know, all the wrong things are happening. That pipeline. Did you see the information from the Wall Street Journal, Sterling, on the influence of the DAPL over the first 6 months?
Revenue
was up $43 million. Expected to be 100 to 110 every year. Unemployment is 2.3. I mean, it's just an economic model of what happens when economic forces are happening and they aren't being overregulated. I mean, the state kept its sovereignty. It kept control of its environmental approval. They never gave it to the EPA, and they kept it. They used the EPA what it should have been used for, as an advisor, not as a rulemaker. And all of the things that they're doing right now are just, you know, classroom examples. As what do they call it? The laboratory of democracy. North Dakota shows what you can do if you do it intelligently and you don't forget economics. Important energy is important. It powers our lives. And there is nothing romantic about living like a good half of the world does right now, with dirty water and unreliable electricity, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. 1.2 billion people live in energy poverty. That's one of the things I hammer on. Anytime I talk about this, I say, look, you say what we don't need is coal plants. We don't need natural gas. We don't need fossil fuels that we can electrify to the developing world with solar and wind. And I say that if I'm a pregnant woman having a problem in a small village in the middle of the night, I need a hospital that's got refrigeration 24 hours a day. I need a hospital that has working monitors and working incubators and electric lights on demand. I need the things that the people in the West take for granted to be there 24 hours a day.
Exactly.
Not when the sun is shining, not when it's convenient for the wind to blow. And to condemn them to continued poverty and premature death is immoral.
Exactly. And I'll reduce my emissions doing it. I mean, you know, liquid natural gas, now that we're shipping it, Sterling, has turned the question, all of these questions, on its head. Why? Because once it's shipped to Asia or to any number of places that are poorer, it replaces cow dung, wood chips, dirty coal, etc. It's emission reducer in itself in a world that is very, parts of the world that is very dirty right now. How can people support that?
But modern coal plants are cleaner than cow dung or charcoal. And that's the thing, that the coal is the most abundant fossil fuel in existence. And the U.S. is the dominant. We are the Saudi Arabia of coal. We could benefit from shipping our coal to sub-Saharan Africa for power plants, for them to burn. They'd have cheap energy. They'd have abundant, reliable energy. They'd have hospitals that can run, schools that can run. Everything that we have in the West, they can have using coal and natural gas. And yet we deny them that. And in fact, the World Bank now, it says it will give no more loans to fossil fuels after, I believe, 2020. I say what's going to happen is China, that's setting up their own bank, investment bank, will be swooping in and financing those things. And Trump should be withdrawing its money from not giving money to the World Bank anymore if it's going to set up those kinds of terms.
Well, there's an awful lot of promises, including totally electric vehicles and blah, blah. You know, honestly, it's all just playing to a crowd. Honestly, you know, as I said to Jason, it's just a beauty contest here. We have to provide, at least people are thinking about this with reality versus this very simplistic anti-intellectual argument about climate change and for everybody to stop using fossil fuels. I mean, it just simply, it goes against history itself. And why? And these people are not willing to give up any of their advantages from natural gas or oil or anything like that. But it is, don't do what I do, do what I say.
That's precisely it. Leonardo DiCaprio flies across the country to receive an environment award in a private jet and tells people don't fly because it produces carbon emissions. He has innumerable numbers of cars, but he shows up at one event in one of his electric cars and he says, look, I'm a good environmentalist. And then he goes to Cannes and rides around in an extended Hummer. They get 3 miles to the gallon.
Have you seen this movie, Sterling? Have you seen this movie?
Which movie? No, I haven't seen it.
He should be ashamed. That's all I'm going to tell you. Plus, yeah. Just a small part of this movie, and it's an embarrassment. Honestly, it's like he's Mr. Magoo. But anyway, he goes to an island off of Africa, and it's, you know, really a poor island.
How did he get there? How did he get to that island? Did he take an electric airplane or?
Let me finish the story. Of course, there's always that. Anyway, he interviews an Englishman who lives there, and the Englishman is the only one in the whole island who had enough money to buy this great wooden sailboat, and he did. So down in the bay, Leo DiCaprio or somebody, whoever, they interview him, and the guy said, he said, I love this island and I love these people. They're so happy. You know, it could have been a slave owner from 200 years ago. You know, they don't get an education. They got 10 people in the family, but they seem so happy. You know, I mean, it's just that kind of sneering attitude that is just, and that's really what that movie Before the Flood is all about. You know, well, we like them, you know, stupid and barefoot. You know, we don't want them to learn how to spell or write. I mean, it's just amazing. Noblesse Oblige, and all, you know, it's just, it is horrible to watch. I've had friends say, well, did you see Leo's movie? And it's like, by the way, I took one for the team here in Sterling. I watched, you know, the 8 or so so-called natural gas fracking DVDs on a Sunday. I watched them all. Besides a couple who tried to do, Peter McClare tried to do something about mining in South America and or maybe an European Union. But otherwise, it was just a bunch of pipe dreams. You know, with no understanding what it really takes to make improvements. I'm even bothered by what Bjorn Lomborg wrote lately. His solution is spend more money on research. I'm thinking to myself, what do you think the private sector is doing right now? Spending billions of dollars on research. Spending a little more government money and creating a reason for itself is not going to cure the world's needs or the world's dilemmas.
But that's the solution right now.
Nobody.
That's the fundamental problem. That's the fundamental problem. They're not focused on people's needs. They're focused on some climate model saying what might happen 100 years from now when people are dying today. It's a moral condemn hundreds of millions of people to premature death today on the off chance that some people's feet in New York City might be a little bit soggier 100 years from now, when in fact we can take the actions today to prevent that from happening. The Dutch have been fighting the seas for hundreds of years. It's below sea level. We know how to do this. But so wealthy Manhattanites don't have to spend their money fighting rising seas, which are going to rise, as far as I can tell from geologic history, until the next ice age comes. They were rising before humans were putting CO2 in the atmosphere. They're going to continue to rise until the next ice age comes. To prevent an extra inch or two of sea level rise, they'll spend billions of dollars rather than saving millions of people today by getting them proper health care.
Well, I'm going to use a metaphor right now. One of the reasons why I've supported the states keeping control of their environment and their energy, and one of the reasons why I supported the AARUC, the Organization of Utility Commissioners, and I fought the Clean Power Plan because it federalized energy. But first and foremost, one of the reasons why I thought it was, at least on a state level, they had somebody representing consumer interests. On the federal level, there's nobody representing the consumer. And you've got 350 million of us. And there's nobody representing us out in Washington right now. Honestly, I mean, so that's part of the problem. And the other part of the problem is that we have silo agencies who are now sharing responsibility for the Internet of Things, blah, blah, all of these things that they are jointly having something to do with. Instead of working together, they've been working separately, like a good bureaucrat would. So you're talking to a believer. I mean, I understand that. I lobbied in Washington. I lobbied in the States for 10 years. Why? Because I worked for an energy-efficient lighting manufacturer. And I had to deal with state utility commissions and energy programs and blah, blah, blah. You know, so, but boy, watching the slow accumulation, the drip, drip, drip of building the clean power plants and then trying to enforce it. And what its influence, even though through the financial world for a loop and created uncertainty, watching how people played. And they were, instead of getting more, they got less. I mean, Washington. Why? Because everybody was playing it safe. They were afraid they'd spend too much money in any single place for fear it would come back to haunt them.
All right. Well, let's wrap her up here today. And Sterling, I'd like you to give you an opportunity to kind of plug your organization and anything you've been working on, or if you have a newsletter, that sort of thing. That's keep people informed of your thoughts and your news that you guys have kicking out. So what's happening at the? Reset one more time. What do you guys have going on?
Well, we're the Heartland Institute. We've been around for 35 years now. I certainly hadn't been with them that long. But we're there out of Arlington Heights, Illinois. We're a free market think tank. We deal with budget, climate, healthcare, education issues, basically economic issues, and we deal with them both at the state and federal level. But we basically try and show the states why markets work better. We fight off bad legislation and fight for good legislation. In my area, we have two, we have numerous, we publish a lot of publications. We have some very profound climate science documents that are accessible to the lay reader, but they're still pretty large. We have some smaller ones, like Why Scientists Disagree on Climate Change. But then we have monthly and weekly newsletters. I have a weekly online-only email newsletter called Climate Change Weekly. Summarizes what I think to be the four or five top climate stories, most important climate stories of the week. And then we have a monthly newspaper called Environment and Climate News, which talks about what's going on in the states, what state legislation has passed, what the courts have ruled, and what's going on at the federal level that impinges on the states. So if you want to know what's going on in the states and how the federal government is impacting the states or how the states are impacting the federal government on environment and climate issues, read Environment and Climate News. It can be found online, or you can subscribe for print edition.
You've been a great source of information, to be honest with you, Sterling. I've known about you guys since I started getting into the energy industry, I want to say in 2002. So, you know, frankly, this is a tip of my hat to you and your group because you guys have done great work. You get abused far more than you deserve. But for people who are serious about this, you've been a great source of information, I think, for people in the industry, but also for utilities, et cetera, et cetera. You represent a strong voice. So on that note.
I appreciate you saying that, and thank you for having me on.
To listen to the entire Weekly Word with Professor Stephen Hines, Jason Spies, and Sterling Burnett this week, the Senior Fellow and Managing Editor of the Heartland Institute, visit thecrudelife.com. That's thecrudelife.com. Of course, all the social media links and company links will be found at thecrudelife.com as well. That's going to do it for the Weekly Word this week. My name is Jason Spies, asking you to check out our sponsors page if you have a chance. They keep interviews like this free. And they literally keep our lights on. From the staff at the Weekly Word, my name is Jason Spies, asking you to be happy, be safe, and make it a fantastic day. The music on today's program is written and performed by the Moody River Band. To find out more about the Moody River Band or their music, visit our website, thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musician tab. That's thecrudelife.com, and click on the Musicians tab.
Now we're gonna have no trouble with the treble. There's no breaks in the bass. It's just you and me, baby, singing it like we did in the good old days. Yeah, we're singing it like they did in the good old days, because we're back to the way. Back to the way. Oh.